complications in knowing the original text. And so, all kinds of changes were made in manuscripts by the scribes who copied them. We'll be looking at the types of changes in greater depth in a later chapter. For the moment, it's enough to know that the changes were made, and that they were made widely, especially in the first 200 years in which the texts were being copied, when most of the copyists were amateurs. One of the leading questions that textual critics must deal with is how to get back to the original text, the text as the author first wrote it, given the circumstance that our manuscripts are so full of mistakes. The problem is exacerbated by the fact that once a mistake was made, it could become firmly embedded in the textual tradition, more firmly embedded, in fact, than the original. That's to say, once a scribe changes a text, whether accidentally or intentionally, then those changes are permanent in his manuscript, unless, of course, another scribe comes along to correct the mistake. The next scribe who copies that manuscript copies those mistakes, thinking they're what the text said, and he adds mistakes of his own. The next scribe who then copies that manuscript copies the mistakes of both his predecessors and adds mistakes of his own, and so on. The only way mistakes get corrected is when a scribe recognizes that a predecessor has made an error and tries to resolve it. There's no guarantee, however, that a scribe who tries to correct a mistake corrects it correctly. That is, by changing what he thinks is an error, he may in fact change it incorrectly, so now there are three forms of the text: the original, the error, and the incorrect attempt to resolve the error. Mistakes multiply and get repeated. Sometimes they get corrected and sometimes they get compounded. And so it goes. For centuries. Sometimes, of course, a scribe may have more than one manuscript at hand and can correct the mistakes in one manuscript by the correct readings of the other manuscript. This does, in fact, improve the situation significantly. On the other hand, it's also possible that a scribe will sometimes correct the correct manuscript in light of the wording of the incorrect one. The possibilities seem endless. Given these problems, how can we hope to get back to anything like the original text, the text that an author actually wrote? It's an enormous problem. In fact, it's such an enormous problem that a number of textual critics have started to claim that we may as well suspend any discussion of the original text because it's inaccessible to us. This may be going too far, but a concrete example or two taken from the New Testament writings can show the problems. Examples of the problems. For the first example, let's take Paul's letter to the Galatians. Even at the point of the original penning of the letter, we have numerous difficulties to consider, which may well make us sympathetic with those who want to give up on the notion of knowing what the original text was. Galatia was not a single town with a single church. It was a region in Asia Minor, or modern Turkey, in which Paul had established churches. When he writes to the Galatians, is he writing to one of the churches? Or to all of them? Presumably, since he doesn't single out any particular town, he means for the letter to go to all of them. Does that mean that he made multiple copies of the same letter, or that he wanted the one letter to circulate to all the churches of the region? We don't know. Suppose he made multiple copies. How did he do it? To begin with, it appears that this letter, like others by Paul, wasn't written by his hand but was dictated to a secretarial scribe. Evidence for this comes at the end of the letter, where Paul added a postscript in his own handwriting so that the recipients would know that it was he who was responsible for the letter, a common technique for dictated letters in antiquity. "See with what large letters I am writing you with my own hand." Galatians chapter 6, verse 11. His handwriting, in other words, was larger and probably less professional in appearance than that of the scribe to whom he dictated the letter. Now, if Paul dictated the letter, did he dictate it word for word? Or did he spell out the basic points and allow the scribe to fill in the rest? Both methods were commonly used by letter writers in antiquity. If the scribe filled in the rest, can we be assured that he filled it in exactly as Paul wanted? If not, do we actually have Paul's words, or are they the words of some unknown scribe? But let's suppose that Paul dictated the letter word for word. Is it possible that in some places the scribe wrote down the wrong words? Stranger things have happened. If so, then the autograph of the letter, that is the original, would already have a mistake in it, so that all subsequent copies wouldn't be of Paul's words, in the places where his scribe got them wrong. Suppose, though, that the scribe got all the words 100% correct. If multiple copies of the letter went out, can we be sure that all the copies were also 100% correct? It's possible, at least, that even if they were all copied in Paul's presence, a word or two here or there got changed in one or the other of the copies. If so, what if only one of the copies served as the copy from which all subsequent copies were made? Then, in the first century, into the second century, and the third century, and so on. In that case, the oldest copy that provided the basis for all subsequent copies of the letter was not exactly what Paul wrote or wanted to write. Once the copy's in circulation, that is, once it arrives at its destination in one of the towns of Galatia, it of course gets copied and mistakes get made. Sometimes scribes might intentionally change the text. Sometimes accidents happen. These mistake-ridden copies get copied, and the mistake-ridden copies of the copies get copied, and so on down the line. Somewhere in the midst of all this, the original copy, or each of the original copies, ends up getting lost, or worn out, or destroyed. At some point, it's no longer possible to compare a copy with the original to make sure it's correct, even if someone has the bright idea of doing so. What survives today, then, is not the original copy of the letter, nor one of the first copies that Paul himself had made, nor any of the copies that were produced in any of the towns of Galatia to which the letter was sent, nor any of the copies of those copies. The first reasonably complete copy we have of Galatians — this manuscript is fragmentary, that is, it has a number of missing parts — is a papyrus called P46. Since it was the 46th New Testament papyrus to be catalogued, which dates to about 200 CE. That's approximately 150 years after Paul wrote the letter. It had been in circulation, being copied sometimes correctly and sometimes incorrectly, for 15 decades before any copy was made that has survived down to the present day. We cannot reconstruct the copy from which P46 was made. Was it an accurate copy? If so, how accurate? It surely had mistakes of some kind, as did the copy from which it was copied, and the copy from which that copy was copied, and so on. In short, it's a very complicated business talking about the original text of Galatians. We don't have it. The best we can do is get back to an early stage of its transmission and simply hope that what we reconstruct about the copies made at that stage, based on the copies that happen to survive in increasing numbers as we move into the Middle Ages, reasonably reflects what Paul himself actually wrote, or at least what he intended to write when he dictated the letter. As a second example of the problems, let's take the Gospel of John. This Gospel is quite different from the other three Gospels of the New Testament, telling a range of stories that differ from theirs and employing a very different style of writing. Here, in John, the sayings of Jesus are long discourses rather than pithy, direct sayings. Jesus never tells a parable, for example, in John, unlike in the other three Gospels. Moreover, the events narrated in John are often found only in this Gospel. For example, Jesus' conversations with Nicodemus in chapter 3, and with the Samaritan woman, chapter 4, or his miracles of turning water into wine, chapter 2, and raising Lazarus from the dead, chapter 10. The author's portrayal of Jesus is quite different, too. Unlike in the other three Gospels, Jesus spends much of his time explaining who he is, the one sent from heaven, and doing signs in order to prove that what he says about himself is true. John no doubt had sources for his account, possibly a source that narrated Jesus' signs, for example, and sources that described his discourses. He put these sources together into his own flowing narrative of Jesus' life, ministry, death, and resurrection. It's possible, though, that John actually produced several different versions of his gospel. Readers have long noted, for example, that chapter 21 appears to be a later add-on. The gospel certainly seems to come to an end in chapter 20, verses 30 to 31, and the events of chapter 21 seem to be a kind of afterthought, possibly added to fill out the stories of Jesus' resurrection appearances and to explain that when the beloved disciple responsible for narrating the traditions in the gospel had died, this was not unforeseen. See chapter 21, verses 22 to 23. Other passages of the gospel also do not cohere completely with the rest. Even the opening verses, chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, which form a kind of prologue to the gospel, appear to be different from the rest. This highly celebrated poem speaks of the Word of God, who existed with God from the beginning and was himself God, and who became flesh in Jesus Christ. The passage is written in a highly poetic style not found in the rest of the gospel. Moreover, while its central themes are repeated in the rest of the narrative, some of its most important vocabulary is not. Thus, Jesus is portrayed throughout the narrative as the one who came from above, but never is he called the Word elsewhere in the gospel. Is it possible that this opening passage came from a different source than the rest of the account, and that it was added as an appropriate beginning by the author after an earlier edition of the book had already been published? Assume, for a second, just for the sake of the argument, that chapter 21 and chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, were not original components of the gospel. What does that do for the textual critic who wants to reconstruct the original text? Which original is being constructed? All our Greek manuscripts contain the passages in question. So does the textual critic reconstruct as the original text the form of the gospel that originally contained them? But shouldn't we consider the original form to be the earlier version which lacked them? And if one wants to reconstruct that earlier form, is it fair to stop there with reconstructing, say, the first edition of John's Gospel? Why not go even further and try to reconstruct the sources that lie behind the Gospel, such as the signs sources and the discourse sources, or even the oral traditions that lie behind them? These are questions that plague textual critics, and that have led some to argue that we should abandon any quest for the original text, since we can't even agree on what it might mean to talk about the original of, say, Galatians or John. For my part, however, I continue to think that even if we cannot be 100% certain about what we can attain to, we can at least be certain that all the surviving manuscripts were copied from other manuscripts, which were themselves copied from other manuscripts, and that it's at least possible to get back to the oldest and earliest stage of the manuscript tradition for each of the books of the New Testament. All our manuscripts of Galatians, for example, evidently go back to some text that was copied. All our manuscripts of John evidently go back to a version of John that included the prologue and chapter 21. And so we must rest content knowing that getting back to the earliest, attainable version is the best we can do, whether or not we've reached back to the original text. This oldest form of the text is no doubt closely, very closely, related to what the author originally wrote, and so it's the basis for our interpretation of his teaching. Reconstructing the texts of the New Testament. Similar problems, of course, apply to all our early Christian writings, both those in the New Testament and those outside it, whether Gospels, Acts, Epistles, Apocalypses, or any of the other kinds of early Christian writing. The task of the textual critic is to determine what the earliest form of the text is for all these writings. As we'll see, there are established principles for making this determination, ways of deciding which differences in our manuscripts are mistakes, which are intentional changes, and which appear to go back to the original author. But it's not an easy task. The results, on the other hand, can be extremely enlightening, interesting, and even exciting. Textual critics have been able to determine with relative certainty a number of places in which manuscripts that survive do not represent the original text of the New Testament. For those who are not at all familiar with the field, but who know the New Testament well, say in English translation, some of the results can be surprising. To conclude this chapter, I'll discuss two such passages. Passages from the Gospels, in this case, that we are now fairly certain didn't originally belong in the New Testament, even though they became popular parts of the Bible for Christians down through the centuries and remain so today. The woman taken in adultery. The story of Jesus and the woman taken in adultery is arguably the best-known story about Jesus in the Bible. It certainly has always been a favorite in Hollywood versions of his life. It even makes it into Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, although that movie focuses only on Jesus' last hours. The story is treated in one of the rare flashbacks. Despite its popularity, the account is found in only one passage of the New Testament, in John chapter 7, verse 53, through chapter 8, verse 12. And it appears not to have been original even there. The storyline is familiar. Jesus is teaching in the temple, and a group of scribes and Pharisees, his sworn enemies, approach him, bringing with them a woman who had been caught in the very act of adultery. They bring her before Jesus because they want to put him to the test. The law of Moses, as they tell him, demands that such a one be stoned to death. But they want to know what he has to say about the matter. Should they stone her or show her mercy? It's a trap, of course. If Jesus tells them to let the woman go, he will be accused of violating the law of God. If he tells them to stone her, he would be accused of dismissing his own teachings of love, mercy, and forgiveness. Jesus does not immediately reply. Instead, he stoops to write on the ground. When they continue to question him, he says to them, "Let the one who is without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her." He then returns to his writing on the ground, while those who have brought the woman start to leave the scene, evidently feeling convicted of their own wrongdoing, until no one is left but the woman. Looking up, Jesus says, "Woman, where are they? Is there no one who condemns you?" To which she replies, "No one, Lord." He then responds, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." It's a brilliant story, filled with pathos and a clever twist in which Jesus uses his wits to get himself, not to mention the poor woman, off the hook. Of course, to a careful reader, the story raises numerous questions. If this woman was caught in the act of adultery, for example, where's the man she was caught with? Both of them are to be stoned, according to the law of Moses. See Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. Moreover, when Jesus wrote on the ground, what exactly was he writing? According to one ancient tradition, he was writing the sins of the accusers, who, seeing that their own transgressions were known, left in embarrassment. And even if Jesus did teach the message of love, did he really think that the law of God given by Moses was no longer in force and should not be obeyed? Did he think sins should not be punished at all? Despite the brilliance of the story, its captivating quality and its inherent intrigue, there's one other enormous problem that it poses. As it turns out, it was not originally in the Gospel of John. In fact, it was not originally part of any of the Gospels. It was added by later scribes. How do we know this? In fact, scholars who work on the manuscript tradition have no doubts about this particular case. Later in this book, we'll be examining in greater depth the kinds of evidence that scholars adduce for making judgments of this sort. Here I can simply point out a few basic facts that have proved convincing to nearly all scholars of every persuasion. The story is not found in our oldest and best manuscripts of the Gospel of John. Its writing style is very different from what we find in the rest of John, including the stories immediately before and after. And it includes a large number of words and phrases that are otherwise alien to the Gospel. The conclusion is unavoidable. This passage was not originally part of the Gospel. How, then, did it come to be added? There are numerous theories about that. Most scholars think that it was probably a well-known story circulating in the oral tradition about Jesus, which at some point was added in the margin of a manuscript. From there, some scribe or other thought that the marginal note was meant to be part of the text, and so inserted it immediately after the account that ends in John chapter 7, verse 52. It's noteworthy that other scribes inserted the account in different locations in the New Testament. Some of them after John chapter 21, verse 25, for example, and others, interestingly enough, after Luke chapter 21, verse 38. In any event, whoever wrote the account, it was not John. That naturally leaves readers with a dilemma. If this story was not originally part of John, should it be considered part of the Bible? Not everyone will respond to this question in the same way, but for most textual critics, the answer is no. The last 12 verses of Mark. The second example that we'll consider may not be as familiar to the casual reader of the Bible, but it's been highly influential in the history of biblical interpretation and poses comparable problems for the scholar of the textual tradition of the New Testament. This example comes from the Gospel of Mark and concerns its ending. In Mark's account, we're told that Jesus is crucified and then buried by Joseph of Arimathea on the day before the Sabbath, chapter 15, verses 42 to 47. On the day after Sabbath, Mary Magdalene and two other women come back to the tomb in order properly to anoint the body, chapter 16, verses 1 to 2. When they arrive, they find that the stone has been rolled away. Entering the tomb, they see a young man in a white robe who tells them, "Do not be startled. You are seeking Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He has been raised and is not here. See the place where they laid him?" He then instructs the women to tell the disciples that Jesus is preceding them into Galilee and that they will see him there, just as he told you. But the women flee the tomb and say nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Chapter 16, verses 4 to 8. Then come the last 12 verses of Mark in many modern English translations, verses that continue the story. Jesus himself is said to appear to Mary Magdalene, who goes and tells the disciples, but they do not believe her. Verses 9 to 11. He then appears to two others, verses 12 to 14, and finally to the 11 disciples, the 12, not including Judas Iscariot, who are gathered together at table. Jesus upbraids them for failing to believe, and then commissions them to go forth and proclaim his gospel to the whole creation. Those who believe and are baptized will be saved, but those who do not will be condemned. And then come two of the most intriguing verses of the passage. And these are the signs that will accompany those who believe. They will cast out demons in my name. They will speak in new tongues, and they will take up snakes in their hands. And if they drink any poison, it will not harm them. They will place their hands upon the sick and heal them. Verses 17 to 18. Jesus is then taken up into heaven and seated at the right hand of God. And the disciples go forth into the world proclaiming the gospel, their words being confirmed by the signs that accompany them. Verses 19 to 20. It's a terrific passage, mysterious, moving, and powerful. It's one of the passages used by Pentecostal Christians to show that Jesus' followers will be able to speak in unknown tongues, as happens in their own services of worship. And it's the principal passage used by groups of Appalachian snake handlers, who till this day take poisonous snakes in their hands in order to demonstrate their faith in the words of Jesus, that when doing so, they will come to no harm. But there's one problem. Once again, this passage was not originally in the Gospel of Mark. It was added by a later scribe. In some ways, this textual problem is more disputed than the passage about the woman taken in adultery, because without these final verses, Mark has a very different and hard-to-understand ending. That doesn't mean that scholars are inclined to accept the verses, as we'll see momentarily. The reasons for taking them to be an addition are solid, almost indisputable. But scholars debate what the genuine ending of Mark actually was. Given the circumstance that this ending found in many English translations, though usually marked as inauthentic, and in later Greek manuscripts, is not the original. The evidence that these verses were not original to Mark is similar in kind to that for the passage about the woman taken in adultery, and again, I don't need to go into all the details here. The verses are absent from our two oldest and best manuscripts of Mark's Gospel, along with other important witnesses. The writing style varies from what we find elsewhere in Mark. The transition between this passage and the one preceding it is hard to understand. For example, Mary Magdalene is introduced in verse 9 as if she hadn't been mentioned yet, even though she is discussed in the preceding verses. There is another problem with the Greek that makes the transition even more awkward. And there are a large number of words and phrases in the passage that are not found elsewhere in Mark. In short, the evidence is sufficient to convince nearly all textual scholars that these verses are an addition to Mark. Without them, though, the story ends rather abruptly. Notice what happens when these verses are taken away. The women are told to inform the disciples that Jesus will precede them to Galilee and meet them there, but they, the women, flee the tomb and say nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And that's where the gospel ends. Obviously, scribes thought the ending was too abrupt. The women told no one? Then, did the disciples never learn of the resurrection? And didn't Jesus himself ever appear to them? How could that be the ending? To resolve the problem, scribes added an ending. Some scholars agree with the scribes in thinking that chapter 16, verse 8 is too abrupt an ending for a gospel. As I've indicated, it's not that these scholars believe the final 12 verses in our later manuscripts were the original ending. They know that's not the case. But they think that possibly the last page of Mark's gospel, one in which Jesus actually did meet the disciples in Galilee, was somehow lost, and that all our copies of the gospel go back to this one truncated manuscript without the last page. That explanation is entirely possible. It's also possible, in the opinion of yet other scholars, that Mark did indeed mean to end his gospel with chapter 16, verse 8. It certainly is a shocker of an ending. The disciples never learn the truth of Jesus' resurrection because the women never tell them. One reason for thinking that this could be how Mark ended his gospel is that some such ending coincides so well with other motifs throughout his gospel. As students of Mark have long noticed, the disciples never do seem to get it in this gospel, unlike in some of the other gospels. They are repeatedly said not to understand Jesus. Chapter 6, verses 51 to 52, chapter 8, verse 21. And when Jesus tells them on several occasions that he must suffer and die, they manifestly fail to comprehend his words. Chapter 8, verses 31 to 33, chapter 9, verses 30 to 32, chapter 10, verses 33 to 40. Maybe, in fact, they never did come to understand, unlike Mark's readers, who can understand who Jesus really is from the very beginning. Also, it's interesting to note that throughout Mark, when someone comes to understand something about Jesus, Jesus orders that person to silence. And yet often the person ignores the order and spreads the news. For example, chapter 1, verses 43 to 45. How ironic that when the women at the tomb are told not to be silent but to speak, they also ignore the order and are silent. In short, Mark may well have intended to bring his reader up short with this abrupt ending, a clever way to make the reader stop, take a faltering breath, and ask, "What?" Conclusion. The passages discussed above represent just two out of thousands of places in which the manuscripts of the New Testament came to be changed by scribes. In both of the examples, we're dealing with additions that scribes made to the text, additions of sizable length. Although most of the changes are not of this magnitude, there are lots of significant changes, and lots more insignificant ones, in our surviving manuscripts of the New Testament. In the chapters that follow, we will want to see how scholars began to discover these changes and how they developed methods for figuring out what the oldest form of the text or the original text is. We'll especially like to see more examples of where this text has been changed and how these changes affected our English translations of the Bible. I would like to end this chapter simply with an observation about a particularly acute irony that we seem to have discovered. As we saw in chapter 1, Christianity from the outset was a bookish religion that stressed certain texts as authoritative scripture. As we've seen in this chapter, however, we don't actually have these authoritative texts. This is a textually oriented religion whose texts have been changed, surviving only in copies that vary from one another, sometimes in highly significant ways. The task of the textual critic is to try to recover the oldest form of these texts. This is obviously a crucial task, since we can't interpret the words of the New Testament if we don't know what the words were. Moreover, as I hope should be clear by now, knowing the words is important not just for those who consider the words divinely inspired. It's important for anyone who thinks of the New Testament as a significant book, and surely everyone interested in the history, society, and culture of Western civilization thinks so. Because the New Testament, if nothing else, is an enormous cultural artifact, a book that's revered by millions and that lies at the foundation of the largest religion of the world today. Chapter 3. Texts of the New Testament. Editions, manuscripts, and differences. The copying practices we have considered thus far have been principally those of the first 3 centuries of Christianity, when most of the copyists of the Christian texts were not professionals trained for the job, but simply literate Christians of this or that congregation, able to read and write, and so called upon to reproduce the texts of the community in their spare time. Because they were not highly trained to perform this kind of work, they were more prone to make mistakes than professional scribes would have been. This explains why our earliest copies of the early Christian writings tend to vary more frequently from one another and from later copies than do the later copies, say, of the High Middle Ages, from one another. Eventually, a kind of professional scribal class came to be a part of the Christian intellectual landscape, and with the advent of professional scribes came more controlled copying practices, in which mistakes were made much less frequently. Before that happened, during the early centuries of the Church, Christian texts were copied in whatever location they were written or taken to. Since texts were copied locally, it's no surprise that different localities developed different kinds of textual tradition. That is to say, the manuscripts in Rome had many of the same errors because they were, for the most part, in-house documents copied from one another. They were not influenced much by manuscripts being copied in Palestine, and those in Palestine took on their own characteristics, which were not the same as those found in a place like Alexandria, Egypt. Moreover, in the early centuries of the Church, some locales had better scribes than others. Modern scholars have come to recognize that the scribes in Alexandria, which was a major intellectual center in the ancient world, were particularly scrupulous, even in these early centuries, and that there, in Alexandria, a very pure form of the text of the early Christian writings was preserved, decade after decade, by dedicated and relatively skilled Christian scribes. Professional Christian Scribes. When did the Church begin to use professional scribes to copy its texts? There are good reasons for thinking that this happened sometime near the beginning of the 4th century. Until then, Christianity was a small, minority religion in the Roman Empire, often opposed, sometimes persecuted. But a cataclysmic change occurred when the Emperor of Rome, Constantine, converted to the faith about 312 CE. Suddenly, Christianity shifted from being a religion of social outcasts, persecuted by local mobs and imperial authorities alike, to being a major player in the religious scene of the empire. Not only were persecutions halted, but favors began to pour out upon the Church from the greatest power in the Western world. Massive conversions resulted, as it became a popular thing to be a follower of Christ in an age in which the emperor himself publicly proclaimed his allegiance to Christianity. More and more highly educated and trained persons converted to the faith. They naturally were the ones most suited to copy the texts of the Christian tradition. There are reasons to suppose that about this time, Christian scriptoria arose in major urban areas. A scriptorium is a place for the professional copying of manuscripts. We have hints of Christian scriptoria functioning by the early part of the 4th century. In 331 CE, the Emperor Constantine wanting magnificent Bibles to be made available to major churches he was having built, wrote a request to the bishop of Caesarea, Eusebius, to have 50 Bibles produced at imperial expense. Eusebius treated this request with all of the pomp and respect it deserved, and saw that it was carried out. Obviously, an accomplishment of this magnitude required a professional scriptorium, not to mention the materials needed for making lavish copies of the Christian scriptures. We are clearly in a different age from just a century or two earlier, when local churches would simply request that one of their members cobble together enough free time to make a copy of a text. Starting in the 4th century, then, copies of scripture began to be made by professionals. This naturally curtailed significantly the number of errors that crept into the text. Eventually, as the decades grew into centuries, the copying of the Greek scriptures became the charge of monks working out of monasteries, who spent their days copying the sacred text carefully and conscientiously. This practice continued on down through the Middle Ages, right up to the time of the invention of printing with movable type in the 15th century. The great mass of our surviving Greek manuscripts come from the pens of these medieval Christian scribes who lived and worked in the East, for example, in areas that are now Turkey and Greece, known as the Byzantine Empire. For this reason, Greek manuscripts from the 7th century onward are sometimes labeled Byzantine manuscripts. As I've pointed out, anyone familiar with the manuscript tradition of the New Testament knows that these Byzantine copies of the text tend to be very similar to one another, whereas the earliest copies vary significantly both among themselves and from the form of text found in these later copies. The reason for this should now be clear. It had to do with who was copying the texts, professionals, and where they were working in a relatively constricted area. It would be a grave mistake, though, to think that because later manuscripts agree so extensively with one another, they are therefore our superior witnesses to the original text of the New Testament. For one must always ask, where did these medieval scribes get the texts they copied in so professional a manner? They got them from earlier texts, which were copies of yet earlier texts, which were themselves copies of still earlier texts. Therefore, the texts that are closest in form to the original are, perhaps unexpectedly, the more variable and amateurish copies of early times, not the more standardized professional copies of later times. The Latin Vulgate. The copying practices I have been summarizing principally involve the eastern part of the Roman Empire, where Greek was and continued to be the principal language. It wasn't long, however, before Christians in non-Greek-speaking regions wanted the Christian sacred texts in their own local languages. Latin, of course, was the language of much of the western part of the empire. Syriac was spoken in Syria, Coptic in Egypt. In each of these areas, the books of the New Testament came to be translated into the indigenous languages, probably sometime in the mid to late 2nd century. And then these translated texts were themselves copied by scribes in their locales. Particularly important for the history of the text were the translations into Latin, because a very large number of Christians in the West had this as their principal language. Problems emerged very soon, however, with the Latin translations of Scripture, because there were so many of them, and these translations differed broadly from one another. The problem came to a head near the end of the 4th Christian century, when Pope Damasus commissioned the greatest scholar of his day, Jerome, to produce an official Latin translation that could be accepted by all Latin-speaking Christians in Rome and elsewhere as an authoritative text. Jerome himself speaks of the plethora of available translations and set himself to resolving the problem. Choosing one of the best Latin translations available and comparing its text with the superior Greek manuscripts at his disposal, Jerome created a new edition of the Gospels in Latin. It may be that he, or one of his followers, was also responsible for the new edition of the other books of the New Testament in Latin. This form of the Bible in Latin, Jerome's translation, came to be known as the Vulgate or Common Bible of Latin-speaking Christendom. This was the Bible for the Western Church, itself copied and recopied many times over. It was the book that Christians read, scholars studied, and theologians used for centuries down to the modern period. Today, there are nearly twice as many copies of the Latin Vulgate as there are Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. The first printed edition of the Greek New Testament. As I've indicated, the text of the New Testament was copied in a fairly standardized form throughout the centuries of the Middle Ages, both in the East, the Byzantine text, and in the West, the Latin Vulgate. It was the invention of the printing press in the 15th century by Johannes Gutenberg, 1400 to 1468, that changed everything for the reproduction of books in general and the books of the Bible in particular. By printing books with movable type, one could guarantee that every page looked exactly like every other page, with no variations of any kind in the wording. Gone were the days when transcribers would each produce different copies of the same text by means of accidental and intentional alterations. What was set in print was set in stone. Moreover, books could be made far more rapidly. No longer did they need to be copied one letter at a time, and as a result, they could be made much more cheaply. Scarcely anything has made a more revolutionary impact on the modern world than the printing press. The next closest thing, which may eventually surpass it in significance, is the advent of the personal computer. The first major work to be printed on Gutenberg's press was a magnificent edition of the Latin Vulgate Bible, which took all of 1450 to 1456 to produce. In the half-century that followed, some 50 editions of the Vulgate were produced at various printing houses in Europe. It may seem odd that there was no impulse to produce a copy of the Greek New Testament in those early years of printing. But the reason isn't hard to find. It's the one already alluded to. Scholars throughout Europe, including biblical scholars, had been accustomed for nearly 1,000 years to thinking that Jerome's Vulgate was the Bible of the Church, somewhat like some modern churches assume that the King James Version is the true Bible. The Greek Bible was thought of as foreign to theology and learning. In the Latin West, it was thought of as belonging to the Greek Orthodox Christians, who were considered to be schismatics, who had branched off from the true Church. Few scholars in Western Europe could even read Greek. And so, at first, no one felt compelled to put the Greek Bible in print. The first Western scholar to conceive the idea of producing a version of the Greek New Testament was a Spanish cardinal named Jiménez de Cisneros, 1437 to 1517. Under his leadership, a group of scholars, including one named Diego López de Zúñiga, or Stunica, undertook a multi-volume edition of the Bible. This was a polyglot edition, that is, it reproduced the text of the Bible in a variety of languages. And so the Old Testament was represented by the original Hebrew, the Latin Vulgate, and the Greek Septuagint, side by side in columns. What these editors thought of the superiority of the Vulgate can be seen in their comments on this arrangement in their preface. They likened it to Christ, represented by the Vulgate, being crucified between two criminals, the false Jews, represented by the Hebrew, and the schismatic Greeks, represented by the Septuagint. The work was printed in a town called Akala, whose Latin name is Complutum. For this reason, Ximenes' edition is known as the Complutensian Polyglot. The New Testament volume was the first to be printed. Volume 5, completed in 1514. It contained the Greek text and included a Greek dictionary with Latin equivalents. But there was no plan to publish this volume separately. All 6 volumes, the 6th included a Hebrew grammar and dictionary to assist in the reading of volumes 1 to 4, were to be published together, and this took considerable time. The entire work was finished, evidently, by 1517. But as this was a Catholic production, it needed the sanction of the Pope, Leo X, before it could appear. This was finally obtained in 1520, but because of other complications, the book did not come to be distributed until 1522, some 5 years after Ximenes himself had died. As we've seen, by this time there were many hundreds of Greek manuscripts, that is, handwritten copies, available to Christian churches and scholars in the East. How did Stunica and his fellow editors decide which of these manuscripts to use and which manuscripts were actually available to them? Unfortunately, these are questions that scholars have never been able to answer with confidence. In the dedication of the work, Ximenes expresses his gratitude to Pope Leo X for Greek copies lent from the Apostolical Library. And so the manuscripts for the edition may have come from the Vatican's holdings. Some scholars, however, have suspected that manuscripts available locally were used. About 250 years after the production of the Complutum, a Danish scholar named Moldenhauer visited Alcalá to survey their library resources in order to answer the question, but he could find no manuscripts of the Greek New Testament at all. Suspecting that the library must have had some such manuscripts at some point, he made persistent inquiries until he was finally told by the librarian that the library had indeed previously contained ancient Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, but that in 1749 all of them had been sold to a rocket maker named Torrio as useless parchments, but suitable for making fireworks. Later scholars have tried to discredit this account. At the very least, though, it shows that the study of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament is not rocket science. The first published edition of the Greek New Testament. Even though the Complutensian Polyglot was the first printed edition of the Greek New Testament, it was not the first published version. As we've seen, the Complutum had been printed by 1514, but it did not see the light of published day until 1522. Between those two dates, an enterprising Dutch scholar, the humanist intellectual Desiderius Erasmus, both produced and published an edition of the Greek New Testament, receiving the honor, then, of editing the so-called Editio Princeps, or first published edition. Erasmus had studied the New Testament, along with other great works of antiquity, on and off for many years, and had considered at some point putting together an edition for printing. But it was only when he visited Basel in August 1514 that he was persuaded by a publisher named Johann Froben to move forward. Both Erasmus and Froben knew that the Complutensian Polyglot was in the works, and so they made haste to publish a Greek text as quickly as possible, although other obligations prevented Erasmus from taking up the task seriously until July of 1515, At that time, he went to Basel in search of suitable manuscripts that he could use as the basis of his text. He didn't uncover a great wealth of manuscripts, but what he found was sufficient for the task. For the most part, he relied on a mere handful of late medieval manuscripts, which he marked up as if he were copy-editing a handwritten copy for the printer. The printer took the manuscripts so marked and set his type directly from them. It appears that Erasmus relied heavily on just one 12th-century manuscript for the Gospels and another, also of the 12th century, for the Book of Acts and the Epistles. Although he was able to consult several other manuscripts and make corrections based on their readings. For the Book of Revelation, he had to borrow a manuscript from his friend, the German humanist Johannes Reuchlin. Unfortunately, this manuscript was almost impossible to read in places, and it had lost its last page, which contained the final six verses of the book. In his haste to have the job done, in those places Erasmus simply took the Latin Vulgate and translated its text back into Greek, thereby creating some textual readings found today in no surviving Greek manuscript. And this, as we will see, is the edition of the Greek New Testament that for all practical purposes was used by the translators of the King James Bible nearly a century later. The printing of Erasmus's edition began in October 1515 and was finished in just 5 months. The edition included the rather hastily gathered Greek text and a revised version of the Latin Vulgate, side by side. In the second and later editions, Erasmus included his own Latin translation of the text in lieu of the Vulgate, much to the consternation of many theologians of the day who still considered the Vulgate to be the Bible of the Church. The book was a large one, nearly 1,000 pages. Even so, as Erasmus himself later said, it was rushed out rather than edited. In his Latin phrasing, Praecipitatum varius quam editum. It's important to recognize that Erasmus' edition was the editio princeps of the Greek New Testament, not simply because it makes for an interesting historical tale, but even more so because, as the history of the text developed, Erasmus' editions, he made five, all based ultimately on this first rather hastily assembled one, became the standard form of the Greek text to be published by Western European printers for more than 300 years. Numerous Greek editions followed, produced by publishers whose names are well known to scholars in this field. Stephanus, Robert-Étienne, Theodore Beza, and Bonaventure and Abraham Elsevier. All these texts, however, relied more or less on the texts of their predecessors, and all those go back to the text of Erasmus, with all its faults, based on just a handful of manuscripts, sometimes just two or even one, or in parts of Revelation, none, that had been produced relatively late in the medieval period. Printers, for the most part, didn't search out new manuscripts that might be older and better in order to base their texts on them. Instead, they simply printed and reprinted the same text, making only minor changes. Some of these additions, to be sure, are significant. For example, Stephanus's third edition of 1550 is notable as the first edition ever to include notes documenting differences among some of the manuscripts consulted. His fourth edition, 1551, is possibly even more significant, as it's the first edition of the Greek New Testament that divides the text into verses. Until then, the text had been printed altogether with no indication of verse division. There's an amusing anecdote associated with how Stephanus did his work for this edition. His son later reported that Stephanus had decided on his verse divisions, most of which are retained for us in our English translations, while making a journey on horseback. Undoubtedly, he meant that his father was working on the road. That is, that he entered verse numbers in the evenings at the inns in which he was staying. But since his son literally says that Stephanus made these changes while on horseback, some wry observers have suggested that he actually did his work in transit, so that whenever his horse hit an unexpected bump, Stephanus's pen jumped, accounting for some of the rather odd verse placements that we still find in our English translations of the New Testament. The larger point I'm trying to make, however, is that all these subsequent editions, those of Stephanus included, ultimately go back to Erasmus Editio Princeps, which was based on some rather late and not necessarily reliable Greek manuscripts. The ones he happened to find in Basel, and the one he borrowed from his friend Reuchlin. There would be no reason to suspect that these manuscripts were particularly high in quality. They were simply the ones he could lay his hands on. Indeed, as it turns out, these manuscripts were not of the best quality. They were, after all, produced some 1,100 years after the originals. For example, the main manuscript that Erasmus used for the Gospels contained both the story of the woman taken in adultery in John and the last 12 verses of Mark, passages that didn't originally form part of the Gospels, as we learned in the preceding chapter. There was one key passage of Scripture that Erasmus' source manuscripts didn't contain, however. This is the account of 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 to 8. Which scholars have called the Johannine comma, found in the manuscripts of the Latin Vulgate, but not in the vast majority of Greek manuscripts, a passage that had long been a favorite among Christian theologians, since it's the only passage in the entire Bible that explicitly delineates the doctrine of the Trinity, that there are three persons in the Godhead, but that the three all constitute just one God. In the Vulgate, the passage reads, "There are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these three are one. And there are three that bear witness on earth, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three are one." It's a mysterious passage, but unequivocal in its support of the traditional teachings of the Church on the triune God who is one. Without this verse, the doctrine of the Trinity must be inferred from a range of passages combined to show that Christ is God, as is the Spirit and the Father, and that there is, nonetheless, only one God. This passage, in contrast, states the doctrine directly and succinctly. But Erasmus didn't find it in his Greek manuscripts, which instead simply read, "There are three that bear witness, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three are one." Where did the Father, the Word, and the Spirit go? They were not in Erasmus' primary manuscript, or in any of the others that he consulted, and so naturally, he left them out of his first edition of the Greek text. More than anything else, it was this that outraged the theologians of his day, who accused Erasmus of tampering with the text in an attempt to eliminate the doctrine of the Trinity and to devalue its corollary, the doctrine of the full divinity of Christ. In particular, Stunica, one of the chief editors of the Complutensian Polyglot, went public with his defamation of Erasmus and insisted that in future editions he return the verse to its rightful place. As the story goes, Erasmus, possibly in an unguarded moment, agreed that he would insert the verse in a future edition of his Greek New Testament on one condition, that his opponents produce a Greek manuscript in which the verse could be found. Finding it in Latin manuscripts was not enough, and so a Greek manuscript was produced. In fact, it was produced for the occasion. It appears that someone copied out the Greek text of the epistles, and when he came to the passage in question, he translated the Latin text into Greek, giving the Johannine comma in its familiar, theologically useful form. The manuscript provided to Erasmus, in other words, was a 16th century production made to order. Despite his misgivings, Erasmus was true to his word and included the Johannine comma in his next edition and in all his subsequent editions. These editions, as I've already noted, became the basis for the editions of the Greek New Testament that were then reproduced time and again by the likes of Stephanus, Beza, and the Elseviers. These editions provided the form of the text that the translators of the King James Bible eventually used, and so familiar passages to readers of the English Bible, from the King James in 1611 onward up until modern editions of the 20th century, include the woman taken in adultery, the last 12 verses of Mark, and the Johannine comma, even though none of these passages can be found in the oldest and superior manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. They entered into the English stream of consciousness merely by a chance of history, based on manuscripts that Erasmus just happened to have handy to him, and one that was manufactured for his benefit. The various Greek editions of the 16th and 17th centuries were so much alike that eventually printers could claim that they were the text that was universally accepted by all scholars and readers of the Greek New Testament, as indeed they were, since there were no competitors. The most quoted claim is found in an edition produced in 1633 by Abraham and Bonaventure Elsevier, who were uncle and nephew, in which they told their readers, in words that have since become famous among scholars, that you now have the text that is received by all, in which we have given nothing changed or corrupted. The phrasing of this line, especially the words, text that is received by all, provides us with the common phrase textus receptus, abbreviated TR, a term used by textual critics to refer to that form of the Greek text that is based not on the oldest and best manuscripts, but on the form of text originally published by Erasmus and handed down to printers for more than 300 years, until textual scholars began insisting that the Greek New Testament should be established on scientific principles based on our oldest and best manuscripts, not simply reprinted according to custom. It was the inferior textual form of the Textus Receptus that stood at the base of the earliest English translations, including the King James Bible, and other editions until near the end of the 19th century.